Senator Hubert H. Humphrey.
Tell some of this time you may have to pay for. You ought not to be wasting it on unnecessary applause. I think I know how you feel, and I know how I feel about you, and that expression has been clear this morning, clear by your wonderful reception, and I hope it's clear to you as to how I feel about our Minnesota AFL-CIO by the fact that this is the first public appearance that I have made since my surgery, which, by the way, wasn't that long ago, a little over 4 weeks ago. I get so restless, I think it was 4 years ago. And also the fact that I brought along Muriel. That's the cap to that. That climaxes the whole thing. See, Muriel's my nurse. She threatens to quit about twice a day because I get a little ornery, a little restless. But she's stuck with me now for better than 41 years of married life, through health and sickness and through good times and less than good times. And we wanted to be together with you today. In fact, she said to me this morning, "Is it all right if I come along?" I said, "It's not only all right. If you don't come along, Dave Rowe is apt to not let me in." Because I happen to know how Dave feels about Muriel. And Audrey, don't worry. It's nothing that's going to complicate things particularly, but it's the way it is. Let me just hurriedly pay my respects to all of the officers of our Minnesota AFL-CIO, particularly to Dave and to Neil and to Leonard, to the officers of COPE, because they do such a good job, to all of you that represent the many locals, the different internationals that are here. This is, to me, an experience that's taken place so often that somebody might say, "Well, isn't it just sort of a routine that you go through?" And I have to respond, no, that it is an experience of refreshment, of renovation, of revitalization. And you'll find out as we go through this speech that I may start out a little wobbly, but I'm going to end up damn good and strong. Now, I ran off without my glasses, without my Kleenex. I am a little more sentimental after some period of what you might call physical trauma than usual. But I guess we'll make it through anyway. It's been a bad weekend. I don't know. I used to like Texas. And then I, first of all, Saturday night, our four twins, they had to put them through 15 innings. And then we lost by one. And then they took a doubleheader from us yesterday. Even that I could tolerate, even though it was a blow. But to have that Roger Staubach run that touchdown in that sudden death, that's too much. I can hardly wait till we can get at him again. And that we will before this year is out. I'm a Vikings fan. I thought our boys played a good game yesterday. We'll get it all together. We had some injuries, had a few bad breaks, but so did the other side. It was something to watch. And I thought, well, after all that sorrow, I got to do what I used to do when I'd be campaigning. And I'd get down and out. I'd say, well, where's the labor crowd? I'd go over to a labor hall. Or I'd go up on the iron range. Or I'd come over to the trades and labor assembly. Or I'd go over to the Central Labor Union. And I'd see my friends and I'd get all pumped up again. And forget, and I'd be able to forget that something went wrong the day before. And that's the way we're going to do it today. I picked up the morning paper and I see that Wendy at long last got a big story in the Minneapolis Tribune. I want to compliment you, Wendy. You got a nice story. Wendy is my esteemed colleague. More significantly, he is my dear, loyal, and longtime friend. And he is doing a magnificent job in the United States Senate. It's not easy to come in, new. Not easy to come on in when you got a senior senator that seems to want to hog the headlines. It's not easy to break in and to make your mark. But in a few months, since January into this month of September, Wendell Anderson has established himself as a strong, effective United States Senator of whom we can be proud in the state of Minnesota. Now, Wendy, I want to keep you a junior senator. I think you ought to know that. I see they got all kinds of bills about how we're going to have a succession in case there's an opening in the Senate. Well, don't anybody depend on it for a few years. It's all right to look ahead, and I think you should, because I long ago announced that this term would finish my so-called senatorial public career. And I've given Jimmy Carter assurance so that he has no fear, I will not run for president. I told him that. Which, by the way, calmed him down. And you should know, and I want you to know, that our relationships are the very best. I hear from him 2 or 3 times a week. We discuss many things, and we've been very busy on the telephone these past 2 weeks. I've been on the telephone with my colleagues. Wendy has made arrangements for me in the Senate to talk to a number of my colleagues, gives me the names of some of those that want to talk with me. There are others that I just pick up the phone and talk to. I talk to our majority leader about our agenda. I work with him, consult with him as to what we ought to be doing. Simply because I'm out here in Minnesota does not mean that I'm not trying to take care of our business in Washington. I have a Minnesota office. It's a good office. We're answering the mail, and I'm reading a lot of it. We're dictating those letters. I'm on the telephone dictating statements. I'm not about ready to have somebody cover me up. I'm not about ready to get lost. I am about ready, if you please, to be found once again. And you're going to find me. I saw Mayor Latimer here when I came in. I'm not going to take all morning here just to thank these fellows, but Mayor, you've done a great job for St. Paul. I just want the mayor to know that. And Warren Spanis. You look great, Warren. You're a fine attorney general. I have a sneaking suspicion that one of these days you'll make a fine judge. Yeah, look good to me. And boy, will they have a battle royal out here then as to who's going to succeed. And I saw my friend also that's here, Donald Frazier. Congressman Frazier has been an extraordinarily good congressman, representing his district with courage and with leadership. 5th Congressional District. I don't know where Don is, but I want to salute him. Don? I don't know how many other members of this. Bruce here, Bruce Bento, who you should be so proud of, and Jimmy Oberstar and Rick Nolan. We've got a great gang down there representing us, and we work together, all of us. And I think we've got one of the finest delegations that ever was sent to Washington. Now, Dave, you mentioned this coalition for labor law reform. I'm the co-chairman. When I first went to Washington, one of the reasons I got there was because the AFL-CIO helped get me there. Old Bill Green was president of the AFL-CIO back in 1948. William Green. A.F. Whitney was the president of the Railroad Brotherhoods. And the infamous Taft-Hartley law had just been passed. And this young fellow that was mayor of Minneapolis was out on the road pointing out what this Taft-Hartley law was going to mean to the workers of America. And it has been an impediment to organization. Make no mistake about it. And it has been able to be turned to the disadvantage of the labor movement. Make no mistake about it. Now the Carter administration and those of us that are the leaders in Congress have agreed upon a package of labor law reform so that when people want to organize, they can organize. So that a recalcitrant employer like the Stevens Company, for example, in the South, cannot by all kinds of legal actions and dilatory tactics prevent people from getting a chance to join the union. And I'm proud to be the co-chairman, and I predict to this audience that we will pass the labor law reforms which the administration will be sending to Congress and which we will mobilize to get enacted. So get behind them. Now, I told Dave and Wendy, I said, gee, you know, you're lucky. I'm not feeling as strong as I ordinarily do. I really don't. It's been a little more difficult this time kind of getting back together. So I said, most likely won't be as long as usual. Well, that was self-deception. Not only that, you wouldn't feel right about it. Some of you go home and whisper, I don't know about old H.H. Didn't hold us for an hour. Well, I can't because I've got to go to the university to get one of those treatments. And the doctors won't wait that long. But I do have a few things I want to say to you. The first thing I want to say to you as individuals and as a movement, if you're going to be something, if you're going to do something, you have to be proud of yourself. And you have to be proud of your heritage as a labor movement, just as you are proud of your family or of your religion or whatever else it may be. And I've always been associated with the labor movement. I told the President of the United States at a private luncheon that we had not long ago, I said, Mr. President, you just have to understand in our discussions, there's just a couple of things that I may be slightly prejudiced on, amongst others. But I said, I never would have been in the United States Senate had it not have been for my friends in the labor movement. And please don't ever ask me to do anything that would in any way injure or cripple or weaken that movement. Secondly, I said, I've got to tell you, I've had a lot of help from my friends in the Jewish community. They've been generous. They've been my friends. And please don't ask me to do anything that would betray their legitimate interests and their deep concern over their role in American life, American politics, and in the state of Israel. I said, other than that, you can ask for almost anything. But I have some loyalties and I have some priorities. And one of my loyalties has been to this great movement. And I'll tell you why. Not because you're perfect. Not because there hasn't been a scoundrel now and then. Because none of us are perfect. We've all made mistakes. And God only knows. Some of us have made too many. But we judge a movement like this by its overall record. And we judge the labor movement on what it has done to lift the standard of living for millions and millions and millions of plain American citizens who today can have their own home, who today have decent working conditions, who today can send their children to a good school. And that is particularly true here in the state of Minnesota, Wendy, where you and the labor movement and others in this state helped improve the educational system of Minnesota until today it stands as the wonder of the nation. It never could have happened without you. Be proud of it, dear friends. Be proud of it. And just remember this. Mom said, yeah, they'll take your picture if you wipe your eyes with the Kleenex. Well, that's all right. Take it. The fellow that doesn't have any tears doesn't have any heart. The history of the labor movement needs to be taught in every school in this land. We need to know our roots, as they say. We learned about roots, didn't we, in 1976. We need to know who we are, what we are, where we come from, how we got here. You've heard me say this before. It is imperative. It is a part of American history. This great nation wasn't built just because somebody sat behind a table and finagled and even financed. Important as finance is, and it is important. Important as planning is, it is important. Important as design is, and it is important. Ultimately, it's the worker. It was the worker that built the railroads, that dug the tunnels, that dredged the rivers, that built the ports, that built the huge skyscrapers, put in the highways, and built the homes. America is a living testimonial to what free men and women organized in free democratic trade unions can do to make a better life. And we ought to be proud of it. Just remember that. The first thing that any authoritarian or any two-bit dictator does is to abolish free labor. That's the first thing. Long before they get to expropriation of land, long before they get to even putting into jail the so-called political prisoners, they abolish a free labor movement. I'm a student of history, and I've been a college teacher, and I've taught every one of my students that. That's the first sign. And in America, thank God, instead of abolishing our labor movement, we're going to strengthen it. And workers today that are not organized, many of them particularly in the Deep South, workers today that do not have the working conditions that they ought to have, are going to have a better chance. Nobody's going to give it to them on a platter. It's not going to be easy. But they're not going to have everything set against them. They're going to have a chance once we get this labor reform bill passed, so that when they have a vote in their plant, and the vote is taken, and if the union wins, the union is recognized, and there's none of this nonsense of delay and litigation and obstruction, such as has prevented the labor movement of the United States from its legitimate growth. Oh, what have you done with free organized labor? Collective bargaining, better wages. Now, every time anybody gets a little better wages, somebody says, inflation, right away. The banker raises the interest rates, they say, sound monetary policy. You know that. One of the main items of inflation has been the cost of money. But for some reason or another, we have been duped into believing that if a worker who puts in a full day's work gets a little pay raise, that it's going to have a bad or ill effect on the economy. But that if somebody can somehow or another finagle the discount rate, or if the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board can raise the prime rate, or some of that, he doesn't raise it, but the private banks get together and raise the prime rate, that's what you call sound monetary management. I served as chairman for 2 years of the Joint Economic Committee, and I'm vice chairman now. And I want to tell you something, they're not pulling the wool over my eyes. I've learned a great deal, and they know it. I'll never forget the day that Arthur Burns told me that his first objective, Chairman Arthur, Mr. Burns, a delightful gentleman, may I say, a conservative gentleman, whose philosophy I do not find myself in agreement, but personally I like him. Arthur Burns said, "You know, Senator, our first obligation is to save the banks." I said, "I understand the importance of that. But," I said, "I want to tell you something. There won't be any money in the banks if we don't save the country. And interest rates and credit terms have a lot to do with what's going to happen to this country. And every one of you in this audience, and all of those like you across this land, have a greatest interest. You should have as big an interest in and as great a concern about those interest rates and those discount rates and all the other hocus-pocus that goes on in this so-called monetary system of ours as they have in your wages." Thank God for collective bargaining. What it's meant to the income of our families. What it's meant for working conditions. What it's meant for grievance procedures. What it's meant for job security. What it's meant for recreation and vacation so that families can get together and travel across this country. What it's meant for pensions and what it's meant for health. Millions of Americans today have health care, not because the government has passed it, because we haven't had the guts to do it, but because negotiators have sat down at the table with their employers and have worked out a health and welfare pension program commonly called fringe benefits, which makes it possible for you as a union member to have good health care with the best of doctors in the best of hospitals and not have to go broke during the whole process. Isn't that a marvelous thing? Now, who does that hurt? See, we need to tell people about this. The doctors get their money. The hospitals get their money. The family still survives. The community is better off. What's all this nonsense about that when you give a little wage increase for a worker, and of course, by the way, you generally negotiate, you know, 3-year contracts, and when they put it in the paper, they put the whole 3-year contract in as if it was all the first year. I tell you, dear friends, a 3-year contract is the first year to catch up for what you just lost. The second year is to try to get a little bit ahead, and the third year is to try to maintain even. So you're really battling hard. But the American worker, and let's get this down straight now, The American worker is the most productive worker in the world. The most productive worker in the world. I can hear somebody say, yeah, you can expect that from Humphrey. Don't expect it from me. That's the official record. We have the best labor relations in the world. Fewer work stoppages than any other industrialized country. Not bad. We have a responsible labor movement. Look at this state. Look at the leadership of the labor movement in this state. It's a responsible labor movement. Enough of that. Now, what's ahead? Mama, you got to see that doctor, don't I? Yes, sir. Let's take a look at what's ahead. I talked about the reform of the labor laws. And one of the things that's got to be done is for the government of the United States, by official declared policy, to state that the goal and the objective of all the policies of the government of the United States is full employment and economic growth. And that is what the Humphrey Hawkins bill is all about. To see to it the Humphrey Hawkins bill, and I want you to get the literature about it. I don't want you to be deceived by these letters to the editors. I don't want you to be fooled by these ill-informed editorials that appear from time to time. I want you to take a look at what we're really trying to do. What we're trying to do is, first of all, to bring together the Bureau of the Budget, the Federal Reserve, the Council of Economic Advisors, and the Cabinet into a program of a plan of economic action that will be presented to the Congress as a concerted, well-developed plan year by year. And the President will present to the Congress his goals, his economic goals for each year. The goal for production, the goal for income, the goal for employment. We're not going to eliminate unemployment in 1 year. We're not going to get over our problems all in 1 year. But if we don't plan, if we don't look ahead, if we don't have something to measure our efforts by, if we don't have any idea where we want to go or how we're going to get there, we're going to be spinning our wheels, and you're going to constantly read that the economy is slipping or sliding or moving or falling, and nobody knows why. The whole purpose of the Humphrey Hawkins bill is to utilize the resources of the government in coordination with private enterprise to maximize private enterprise, to see that private enterprise has the credit, the money, the resources, the trained workers that are necessary to keep this economy of ours growing so that as the labor force grows, we can absorb the new ones and that we can pick up the millions that have been left behind. The second part of the Humphrey Hawkins bill is merely what we're doing today, but not enough. Emergency public works. The Comprehensive Educational Training Program, known as CETA. The Special Aid to Our Cities. The Job Corps. The Youth Employment Program, of which I was a co-author, as was Wendy. But we need to do more of it. Ladies and gentlemen, the greatest enemy America has today is the fact that there are 7 million people capable of working that ought to be working, that are unemployed, and of those 7 million, 3 million are youth between the ages of 16 and 22. And many of them have never had a job. Many of them have never known work discipline. Many of them know nothing of the therapy that comes from work, and they've learned how to live off the street. And I'm here to tell you that as long as you have that many people unemployed, you'll never cut the crime rate. You'll never get at dope addiction. You'll never solve the social and economic problems which you read about, which plague our cities and move into our countryside. Solving the problems of unemployment is not only an economic necessity, it is a social necessity. We need to wage war upon unemployment. We need to have the same commitment to it but we move on it. Even now, even though we're doing five times better than we did, we move slowly. Take a look at how long it has taken us to even set up a job corps center. So many people have got to pick at it, and we have to go through so many different little rules and regulations. Let me tell you, Franklin Roosevelt set up the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the 30s. You remember, some of you, the old CCC camps. He put one man in charge. He called him in March. And he said to this gentleman, by the end of June, I want 500,000 young men in camps, out in the forest, at work, clothed, with the tools, and ready to go to work. From March until June. And by June 30th, 530,000 young men were at work, in the camps, out in the forest, doing the job. It can be done. You just got to make up your mind to do it. Did you know that Roosevelt never had a welfare program? No, the welfare was taken care of by some local county people. He had a work program. If you didn't have a job, there was a job offered. Work. We've got things to do in this country. And we've gone along here, piddling along, and we've been spending billions and billions and billions. We've never made up our mind that America needed something. Forests to be replanted. Cities to be rebuilt. Railroads, my goodness, railroads that need modernization and rebuilding. Hundreds and thousands, over 30,000 bridges in America that are out of date, that slow up our transportation system. Ports that are too old and too small to take care of modern shipping. The list is unlimited. We're 15 years behind in reforestation. It isn't only the elm disease. And by the way, we ought to have an urban forestation program too. Plant trees in our cities, just as we do in our countryside. We've got things to do in this country. And I want the labor movement to start demanding that they be done. That's the way we get things done. Conserve our water. Conserve our land. You remember the great shelter belt program that was done in the 30s to prevent soil erosion? Farmers are asked to plant trees all across America to break up the wind erosion. Some almost 40 million acres were planted. You know what's happened in the last 3 years? Over 30 million of them have been bulldozed out. Why? So you have a few more acres to plant wheat. And today we got 1,100,000,000 bushels of surplus wheat that we don't know what to do with. We not only got more wheat than we know what to do with, driving down the prices of wheat to our farmers, causing them great economic distress, but we have wrecked 40 years planting because we got a little greedy. Just got a little greedy. Dear friends, I know we have an energy shortage, and time doesn't permit. Not only do we need energy conservation, energy development, and all sorts of things which we're working on, solar energy and other forms of energy, but one of the greatest dangers that this country faces is the lowering of its water table for the long term. You see, we got to look ahead. Grandpa Humphrey has no right to just use up the inheritance that came to me and leave nothing for my grandchildren. And we have been doing that. We've been using up our land. We've been using up our water. We've been using up our oil. We've been fouling up our air. And now we're asking ourselves, can we afford to do anything about it? Let me ask you something. If the Soviet Union were to attack us or some other country, and we knew that they were going to conquer large areas, do you think we'd stand back and say, do you think we can afford to defend ourselves? You know what would happen. This country would rally, pray God, soon enough, and we'd wage a battle to the very last person if need be. We wouldn't ask whether we could afford it. Did you ever hear anybody say during World War II, you think we can afford to fight Hitler? And by the way, we financed World War II with scarcity of money, scarcity of commodities, scarcity of supply with 2% interest. 2% money. 2% money. Because we had a president then. We had an economic philosophy that said it could be done. Conservation on every front. We've got a job to do to clean up our cities. We can't afford to let them fall apart. I know, Wendy, that you addressed yourself to many of these questions. But those cities are never going to be cleaned up if you just rely on the yearly appropriations of Congress. The farmers of America would have never been able to develop America if they just depended on each session of Congress as to whether or not they were going to get any land. We passed the Homestead Act, gave every new farmer 160 acres and said, go to it. Every new immigrant, my grandfather got one. We passed the Federal Land Bank Act that financed the purchase of land for the farmers. And the farmers today own the Federal Land Bank. We passed the Production Credit Act so the farmers could get money for production loans. And today the PCAs are owned by the very people that borrowed from them. We passed the Cooperative Banking Act so that the Farmers Union, GTA, and others could be established. We know how it works. During the Great Depression, when there was trouble and they couldn't get money to save their railroads and their businesses, we put up the RFC, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Did it lose the taxpayers any money? It made millions. It made millions and millions of dollars. It saved the railroads, saved business, saved God only knows what. Now we got a bank, a World Bank. Listen, I handled all this legislation. I handled $9 billion worth of it this year for what we call international financial institutions. A World Bank for the world. The International Development Association for very soft loans, 40-year loans with little or no rate of interest for the poorest of the poor countries, for their ghettos and their Harlems and their Huffs. We passed the Inter-American Development Bank. We passed the International Finance Corporation. $9 billion. Of USA government money, your money, which I think was needed for economic development and for world peace. But we understood the importance of having credit available at reasonable terms and reasonable interest on a long-term basis for the building of a free world. When are we going to wake up? If we can have a World Bank, they can loan money to Chile. If we can have a World Bank that can loan money to Afghanistan, and many of us don't even know where it is, then we ought to be able to have a National Domestic Development Bank that can loan money to Minneapolis and St. Paul and New York and Rochester and Los Angeles and San Francisco. I talked about it. It's coming around. I've been only at this now at 15 years. But most everything I ever been at, got ever passed, took about that long. But it's got to come. Because we've got to save those cities. Because the people that live in those cities have to be saved. And it does no good just to pass out food stamps. That's temporary, palliative. It does no good just to see that they, you know, get a little food now and then. Yes, yes, from a point of compassion, God's will being expressed, yes. But what we need is development. What we need is modernization. What we need is rebuilding those cities. We go for civil rights in 1948. I knew they wouldn't go for Medicare in 1949. I knew that they wouldn't go for the Peace Corps in 1958. And I knew they wouldn't go, if you please, for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in 1959. But ultimately they did. If you're going to be a man in politics, you have to be like a soldier on the battlefield. You know there are risks. There's no guarantee of your life. But as somebody once said, I'd rather live 50 years like a tiger than 100 years like a chicken. Thank you very much.